In the middle of last year, the whole world was gripped by the cave rescue saga. 12 boys and their soccer coach in Thailand trapped in a cave that was filling with water. And we know how that story ended now, but imagine being inside that rescue mission and being very unsure who was going to come out alive. Have you ever faced your fears and attempted something you thought was impossible? Tell us how that turned out on our Facebook page. Or send us a text 0418 226 576. Our next guest is a very experienced cave diver and an anaesthetist, which turned out to be a very handy combination. Richard Harris and his fellow diver Craig Challen have just released a book about their role in the rescue. It's called Against All Odds. Richard, welcome.
Hi, Hilary. Thanks for having us.
Though you go by Harry, so I'll stick with that
Harry's
for now.
Good.
Excellent. Now, cave diving, everyone around the office just shuddered whenever I raised it. It's dangerous. Why did you become so hooked on it?
I can't understand this attitude about cave diving. It's a beautiful thing to do. Well, I started out as just a normal open water scuba diver at the tender age of about 13 or 14. I had family, friends and new people with boats and who were into it. So we got into it that way, but did my course when I was about 15, went on to do a lot more at university. And when I was at uni, I guess I fell in with a bad crowd who suggested we go off and try cave diving down in Mount Gambier in the southeast of South Australia. So that's how it all started for me.
And that first experience wasn't that great, but then you had an incredible experience, wasn't it? Visually, what did it look like?
Yeah, initially it wasn't that brilliant. You know, during the training, you don't get to see much. It's a bit like the cave in Thailand. It's all about learning survival skills rather than enjoyment. But later on, I got to visit some beautiful places, and one in particular called Kilsby Sinkhole, which is a really deep but crystal clear hole in the ground. Drops down to about 60 metres, and the water, I often say to people, you know, the most clear tropical water you've ever been snorkeling or diving in just looks filthy compared to the water in these places. It is, as we say, gin clear water. And you can be swimming on the surface and look down and you have a sense that you're almost going to fall through the water because it's so clear. And when the sun shines down into it, it's just, it's like a cathedral. It's just a beautiful place to be.
Now, you're an experienced cave diver, but you're also a fully trained anaesthetist and you've worked in that field for many years. Do they have anything in common?
Well, they do actually. There's quite a bit of overlap in my opinion. You know, being a bit OCD is good for both. It's all about preparation and, you know, being ready to, you know, face any problems that arise. And yeah, I find in my anaesthetic practice, you know, the more worried you are about a patient, the more you think about it overnight beforehand, the more you prepare, the very less likely you are to have any problems during the case. And I think cave diving is a lot like that. The times I've given myself a real fright have often been in dives that I've taken for granted, that I've been a little bit complacent and I've thought, this is a very straightforward dive, I've done this before. And you jump in and maybe haven't thought through things quite as thoroughly as you might otherwise.
Well, you write in the book how you were working in Australia and getting itchy fingers wanting to go over to Thailand when the news started to filter out about this terrible situation. But what was the message you got from the British cave diver and tell us your response too?
Yeah, so this guy, Rick Stanton, who is very much a rock star in our little sport, and I have enormous respect for him. I'd been exchanging texts with him over the previous few days and I'd been suggesting that, you know, if the Australians can help in any way, we can send some cave divers over. I have a role as a search and rescue officer for our cave diving association. And on this particular morning, it was Thursday, the 5th of July, I got this message from Rick and it simply said, what do you think about sedating the boys to bring them out? And my response to him was very emphatic and clear. I said, it's absolutely not an option. And my thought was that that is just a ridiculous thing to even suggest, because how could you possibly render somebody unconscious and then immerse them underwater for 3 hours to bring them out of a cave? I mean, it can only end one way.
And Rick agreed with you at the time, didn't he? He was not hopeful at all.
Well, his view was probably coloured by the fact that he had spent time on the ground there and he knew there was no other option. So he was grasping at straws, really. And I said, look, we're happy to come over, but you better come up with a better plan than that one.
So how did it end up being that plan?
By a process of elimination. Once myself and Craig were over there, we had 24 hours on the ground. We swam through the cave to see the boys. And I realised that, you know, that dive was about 2.6 kilometres long. zero visibility, very tightly restricted cave. You know, it wasn't the hardest cave dive we've ever done, but it was pretty sporting. And finally got to see the boys and the environment they were sitting in, realised that they could not possibly survive there for a lot longer. You know, it was damp, it was wet, mud they were sitting on, they were already developing chest infections. The environment in there was deteriorating rapidly as they'd been eating a lot of food with the natural consequences of that. So the place was a bit on the nose, to say the least. And, you know, by looking at all the plans that were in place, I realised there's nothing we can do to get these boys out. And so this idea of sedation started to loom as a, you know, a real possibility, even though I still did not believe it could work.
We're talking with Richard Harris. Harry, who along with his diving partner Craig Challen has written a book, Against All Odds, which I think aptly sums up what everyone thought about that plan at the time to get the Thai soccer team out of that flooding cave. So when you got there, you've written how you knew that the boys' attitude would be key into whether this was going to succeed. What was the mood underground?
Yeah, well, I was very concerned about the boys, you know, if because they had no food at all for the first 9 days. So they were in a fairly weakened state. They'd lost several kilos, which when you only weigh 30 kilos to start with is significant. So I didn't know what to expect, how they would look. So when we finally got through the cave and visited the boys, I was immensely impressed at their moral, their moral fibre, their morale, I guess I'm trying to say, that they looked like they're in really good spirits. They're all standing, walking, talking, smiling for the most part. You wouldn't think they'd spent nearly 2 weeks, you know, buried at the back of a cave for all that time. So I was really impressed and reassured by their physical state, although I could see that they were deteriorating with these coughs and colds and things. So that gave me a little bit more enthusiasm for the idea of giving them an anaesthetic, but not very much.
Well, and how do you work out the dosages for people who don't weigh much, have lost weight, are starting to develop chest infections and have been living underground for a
week? Yeah, well, I have to say in my career, I've never had to, you know, work out those doses for this particular scenario. Fortunately, we chose a drug called ketamine, which is quite forgiving in terms of those sorts of physiological variables. There was no other choice from the point of view of the anaesthesia. No other drug would have come close to being able to do what was required of it. So that was good to have that in my armamentarium, I guess. But I did have a list of the boys' names and their weights from the Thais outside, and I checked through Dr. Puck, who was a Thai army doctor who was in with the boys by then, and he spoke quite passable English, so I was able to ask him, just tell me the boy's name and remind me what you think the weight is. The other thing is anaesthetists are very skilled at guessing people's weights. I won't try it on you, Hillary, because if I get it wrong, I'll get
it
a slap.
It tends to go down badly, doesn't it?
But no, so, you know, we get a pretty good idea of just an end of the bed measure of what people weigh and how they're going to respond to the anaesthetic.
And you've written that Dr. Pak was an immense comfort underground, wasn't he?
He was an absolute legend. This guy was, you know, he's so overqualified. He's a medical doctor, but he's a Special Forces Army guy. He's a parachutist. He's a Thai Navy SEAL, fully trained Thai Navy SEAL. And he's got these rock star looks. And when you see him dressed in his dress uniform, you know, he's so covered in medals, they just about have to start pinning them on the back of his shirt, you know. So he's got a very good future, that man. And it was great to have a colleague in there. I really felt reassured by that companionship from him. And I think he was quite pleased to see me as well for the same reason.
Well, and it sounds like it was not an auspicious start. You began to feel unwell when you first went in.
Yeah, well, that was actually the second day. So the first day we dived in, that wasn't too bad. But then the second day, which was the first rescue day, I was swimming through the cave and I felt as weak as a kitten. I felt cold and shivery and headachy. I thought, what is wrong with me? You know, maybe yesterday's really taken its toll on me, or maybe I'm getting the flu. Something was really wrong. And I thought, I'm not going to be able to do this for another day if I feel like this. And I was very worried. Anyway, towards the end of the day, I was chatting to Craig and I said, man, I feel terrible. I don't know if I'm up for this. And he said, that's strange. I've got a real bad headache as well. I never get headaches. And one by one, we talked to the other divers. They were all experiencing similar symptoms. And we worked out that the Thais had been so busy filling cylinders with air that they'd actually run out of filters on the compressor. And so the filtration system had failed and we were all getting poisoned with the gas we were breathing. So, I mean, that simple oversight could have wiped out the whole rescue team in one day. So the next day, I'm happy to say I felt like a lion compared to that. I just was so happy to feel back to normal again. I felt good.
I imagine the atmosphere must have been very heightened there. So many different governments and people and groups working together with a really short timeline. What was it like trying to get the rescue done and get it done safely in that situation?
Yeah, so when we arrived, there was a real sense of chaos. You know, you walk into this scene, which is, I haven't been in a war zone, thank goodness, but it might perhaps feel to me the closest thing to what that might be like. There were just people everywhere, different uniforms, different countries, different cliques of people everywhere with their own agenda. And I had a sense of massive disorder. But of course, often in these scenes, there is some order and it just takes a while to see it. And the Thais were doing an excellent job with their leadership and management. The American Air Force brought some real order and coordination to the scene. I mean, the Americans are very good at organising, you know, invasions and such like. So I think if you ever need your 21st or your wedding organised, I'll get the American military to do that. They'd be on top of it. So they were very good at bringing everyone to the table and presenting the facts and summarising stuff. They were brilliant. And then we had the AFP there and DFAT. You know, there were lots of people to guide us. But within the cave diving group, we were pretty autonomous because we were civilians, we were volunteers. We didn't really feel like we had to answer to anyone, particularly since once we entered the cave, we're on our own and we are self-sufficient, independent kind of thinkers. That's why we do this sport. You have to be self-sufficient to survive in caves. So we really made our own plan and we presented that plan to the leadership and said, this is what we think we can do and we're prepared to do. And of course, it's up to the Thais whether they'll give us permission.
And it was fantastic that everybody could work together to make it happen. And the process just sounds insane to someone who's not been cave diving or is at all into cave diving. You go in, you dose up the kids with this sedative, you float them out, you take a top-up dose in case you need to jab them through the wetsuit if they rouse on the way. How does it work? How do you get out of that zero visibility environment safely?
Well, I stayed at the far end of the cave, chamber 9, so I would prepare the children, give them the anaesthetic and then send them out with one of the British divers. One British diver would be responsible for one boy to go all the way out, and we positioned other divers along the way, including Craig, who was at chamber 8, the next chamber down the line. So the British divers were alone with the child for a lot of the time and then would meet up with a support diver. As the child would start to rouse from the anaesthetic, then the British diver would have the responsibility of topping them up and I'd show them how to give the injection, how much to give, how to recognise when to give it, all those sorts of issues. But it was a pretty quick lesson on anaesthesia, you know, something that takes 6 hours of postgraduate study. They had to learn in about 30 minutes. Including the practical session of injecting an empty water bottle once. So that signed off their practical competency. So those guys are incredible, you know, pragmatic, courageous men. I mean, I have huge respect for them to take on that.
You nearly lost one on the way back, didn't you?
Well, more than once, I'm sure. You know, I'll never know the full drama of what happened on those trips out of the cave, but I certainly am aware of several incidents on the way out, including one boy who appeared to stop breathing and, you know, we were about to start resuscitation when he suddenly started breathing by himself. So I don't want people to think it was all plain sailing.
No, and I understand somebody lost hold of the guideline at one point and that's a huge risk, isn't it?
Yeah, so in zero visibility water, that rope that has been laid through the cave is literally your lifeline. You have to keep a hand on it at all times. If you lose that, then you're in serious trouble. And that's exactly what happened to one of the British divers as he took the last child out of the cave.
And across the whole rescue mission, there was the tragic death of one of the Thai Navy SEALs. And I understand there's a monument to him now at the entrance to the cave. Harry, when you go cave diving now, is it all just lovely fun and sunshine and that cathedral-like beautiful clear water, or do you take something of the rescue in with you now?
Oh, it hasn't changed my view on cave diving at all. You know, I've always been passionate about it, and this has done nothing to diminish that enthusiasm. In fact, you know, when I tell my wife I'm off to Mount Gambier for the weekend and she gives me that look, that, you know, that, you know, probably blokes who go golfing every Wednesday afternoon, the same look those guys get. And vice versa. I'm sure there's plenty of wives sneaking out as well. you know, I can just say, well, you know, this is a life-saving sport. I have to keep my skills up. So she just shakes her head.
Yeah, practically tax deductible now.
Of course.
Yeah. I did also want to ask you, you wrote that you thought the fuss would die down after a week or two. How's that going for you?
Well, I thought it'd be more like a couple of days. In fact, I didn't even know there would be a fuss, to be honest, because we were completely oblivious to this story, the fact that it was a worldwide interest. We were head down in the cave and, you know, we're just going about our business. And look, I've worked for the emergency services with the South Australian Ambulance. There are people out there fighting fires as we speak. All those people go about their job, and this felt like a job to me, without any expectation of recognition or reward. It's just what you do. And so I was acutely embarrassed by all the fuss when we came out of this cave, because I felt that I'd been preparing for an incident like this by training for it. I was there as a doctor, as an Australian Medical Assistance Team member. I really honestly felt like we were there doing a job. I know it was a bit different and a bit unusual, but it was the script, it was the Hollywood nature of this story that, of course, threw us into the limelight. And I kind of understand it now, but I don't feel any different about it. I think we were just there doing the best we could, and anyone with the same set of skills would have done the same.
Well, top work. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the foreword to the book is by James Cameron. That's clearly a script leaping out to be made there. Thanks so much for joining us on Life Matters today and telling us a little bit of your story, Harry.
Thank you, Hilary.
The book's called Against All Odds by Craig Challen and Richard Harris. And that was about the rescue of the Wild Boar Thai soccer team. You're on RN.